Hi, everybody. My name is Laurel, and I'm an alcoholic. Oh, it's great to look out here and see you all today. I want to thank the board for asking me to come up here and talk. It's a real honor and a privilege to be here, and I want to thank you all for being here. You know, and especially want to thank the speakers that have gone before me. I was talking to Kevin last night, and he said, well, we got three men on base, and you're up. And I thought, oh, my God, I don't play baseball. So anyway, what they have told me that I need to do is share what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, speaking is probably not one of my favorite things to do, but they've told me that I need to do this to treat my disease, and I want to stay sober today more than I do anything else, and so I'm willing to get up and share what it was like for me. And before I talk, I always get down on my knees, and this morning I did it twice, and I asked God, I said, please, please get my pride, ego, and fear out of the way. Let me just be a channel for you and give the message that you want me to say. So I really have no idea what I'm going to say this morning, but I'm going to do the best job that I can. I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and I was an only child. And my parents had been married for 14 years before I was born. And it was supposed to be a great event, you know. They were just delighted to have me and everything, and yet they divorced 3 years later. And I remember the night that my dad came home and told my mother and I to get out. They had been raising one of my cousins before I was born, and she and I were sitting on the steps to the basement. We could hear them down there arguing. My mother was ironing, and she was crying, and ironing and crying, and my dad was yelling and throwing these cans at her. And we were huddled up there on the top of the steps, and I remember just being so scared. And it never occurred to me to ask my mother what kind of cans was my dad throwing at her until I got sober. And sometime in sobriety, I started wondering, was he throwing Coke cans at her or what? And no, they were beer cans. And it's important for me to tell this because I believe that I have a disease, and I believe that it's genetically predisposed in me. Now, I know that might be controversial, but that's what I believe, and from reading the doctor's opinion, I think that I had this allergy to alcohol before I ever took the first drink, because I did not grow up in an alcoholic home. When my mother and father divorced, I didn't see him again, really, until I was in my mid-20s, and my mother and I, everything was in total chaos when we had to move out. She had not worked in 17 years. She had to get a job. She took me down to Tennessee. My family's all from Nashville. And took me down there and left me with my cousins and my grandmother down there. And I remember hiding underneath the kitchen table, just being absolutely filled with fear, just consumed with fear and terror, and hiding under that table, and I would not come out. And they had to get under there to feed me. And that fear just stayed with me always. You know, till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it just consumed me, and I would drink alcohol to get rid of that fear. Well, when she finally got a job and took me back home, we had this little apartment, didn't have a telephone, I think it was like a two-room apartment, didn't have a car, didn't have anything, and she would sit on the front porch and she would cry. You know, and I'd sit there and I'd say, oh, Mommy, please don't cry. I'm here. I'll take care of you. Don't cry. And I'm 4 years old, and I'm already assuming this role of caretaker. You know, I wanted to take care of her. And even though we didn't have anything to speak of materially, those were some of the best years of my life because my mother and I developed a really strong bond, and I loved her more than anybody in the world. Well, she remarried when I was 6 and a half, and I thought this man was our knight in shining armor. He was absolutely great. And it started into what I consider to be a normal childhood. My mother didn't drink hardly ever. Occasionally, she might have a beer on a Saturday afternoon with a girlfriend laying out in the sun. My stepfather, he didn't drink. I mean, they might have a cocktail at once every 3 or 4 years. I mean, it just was not around our home. And I didn't grow up in any kind of abuse. I do know that I was taught some things that I think girls my generation were taught, like, you know, it's not nice to get angry. You know, nice girls don't do that. You know, you don't show that kind of display. And so I didn't know how to deal with anger. I never saw it at home. My parents didn't get angry. You know, I did all the things that kids do normally. You know, I had bicycles, I took ballet lessons and art lessons, and I was just had a fun time as a child. I loved school. It was one thing that I could really excel at, and I liked to be the teacher's pet, you know, be a real people pleaser. And this created this image about me that I was a good girl. You know, Laurel wouldn't do this. You know, she wouldn't do something bad like cut school and go to Cincinnati for the day. You know, she would never do anything like that. So I was able to get away with a whole lot. And, you know, that kind of worked against me. It really did. So things were pretty much fine until I got into puberty, and then everything just went haywire. You know, I really feel sorry for people in puberty. It's just awful. I started doing things that I had never done before, like crawling out the window in the middle of the night and running around the neighborhood and just insane things. Now, I haven't talked about alcohol, really, because it hasn't been in the picture. But I took my first drink. I remember my first taste of alcohol ever was when I was 11 years old. And a cousin of mine was over at the house, and she had mixed this highball in this tall, frosty glass, and it was bourbon and wink. And it smelled so good, and it was so pretty, and I tasted it, and I just loved the way it tasted. I thought it was wonderful. I don't remember getting high or getting a buzz or anything, but I remember thinking, yum, yum. I can't wait until I'm an adult and I can have some of those. I just thought it was neat. Well, when I was 13, I decided I was an adult, you know. And I started running around with people that were older than me. I always did this. I felt really comfortable with people that were older than me. And I had a lot of guts at 13 and 14 years old, and they'd put me up to going into these liquor stores and buying alcohol, and I would do it. I'd do it. I'd turn my ring around, and I'd go in with some guy and pretend like I was married, and he was home on leave from the service, and we just needed a half a pint so that we could have a nice evening. And they'd sell it to me. I mean, I can't believe it. They would sell it to me. And if they didn't, we'd go to another store, and I'd go in and buy it. So there were about a dozen of us kids that hung around together, and we'd just take this pint or half pint and split it among us for the evening, and nobody got drunk or crazy or out of control, but I liked the way that it made me feel. It made me feel whole, you know, like normal. So I progressed through high school just doing that, and I decided that I needed to get out of high school. I was very bored with it, and I wanted to graduate. So I graduated when I was 16, and back then that was sort of an unheard of thing to do. My parents had to go to the Board of Education and get special permission and all that stuff, and I went to college at 16, and I had arrived. I absolutely loved it. I ran with the older crowd. There was always alcohol available. There was never a problem getting it. This was in the 70s, and, you know, kind of like the hippie days, and my friends, they played in a band, and, you know, there was drugs available. You know, I experimented with a few things, but they did not do for me what alcohol did. Alcohol was perfect. I loved it. So my drinking just continued to be a weekend thing of partying and, you know, getting drunk. I remember the first time I threw up. I'd been out drinking and came home and passed out in bed, I guess. I thought I went to sleep, but I've learned now I think I passed out. And I threw up all over the bed. And when I woke up the next morning, I'd been drinking Coke and double bourbons and eating popcorn. So you can imagine what it was like. And it was Christmas morning. And I told my mother that the dog did it. We had this little poodle. And I said, the dog did it. They never said anything. I don't know whether they believe me or not. But what all this stuff was doing for me was setting up this habit of lying. You know, from the time I was 13 years old, I started lying about my drinking. And I just continued to lie on and on and on. Well, when I was about 19 years old, a lot of my girlfriends were getting married, and so I decided I needed to do that also. And my parents were not going to let me move out into an apartment, so I needed to find a man that could support me financially. And there was this guy that I knew. I'd known him for a number of years, and he was 7 years older than me, so I decided to marry him. And we did. We had the big white wedding with all the trappings and everything. It was lovely. And about a year after we were married, during this time, my drinking had been a weekend deal. And after about a year after we were married, I came home and I found him in bed with a man, another man, and it absolutely devastated me. Now, I had been this sort of, I guess, little princess. I never really thought about it that way, but my parents had taught me, you know, be nice to other people and they'll be nice to you, and I think my self-esteem was fairly well intact other than the fact that alcohol helped me feel better, but I just lost it. I absolutely lost it, and this is when I began to drink alcohol with a purpose. Before that, it had been kind of a social lubricant, but I discovered that alcohol would take every bit of the pain away, every bit of the fear away from me. So I moved out and into an apartment with my cats, and I started drinking around the clock. And I had a job at a bakery. Now, I had graduated from college, but I didn't have a good job. But this job at the bakery suited me just fine because I had to be there at 5 o'clock in the morning. And when I got off at noon, I would start drinking. And I would just drink until sometime way up in the middle of the night till I'd pass out, get up at 4 o'clock, stagger into that bakery for another day. Well, I did this for a couple of months, and I was crazy. I was crazy as a loon. And I went out to Central State to check myself in. Now, Central State is the mental hospital in Louisville. It's the heavy-duty one. And so I went out there and to check myself in, and I told them what was going on. I didn't mention the alcohol. You know, I didn't mention that. And I said, I'm here, you know, to be checked in. And they said, oh, no, we're not going to accept you. You just have some emotional problems. You talk about rejection. You know, I'm there to turn myself in, and they send me away. So they put me into a day program, and they gave me Seconal to take to help me sleep because I told them, oh, I'm having a real problem sleeping. And they said, okay, you know, we'll give you this Seconal, but don't drink when you take it. I said, okay, I won't. Went home, drank, took Seconal. And to me, that is just one instance of the grace of God and the miracle in my life that I'm not dead, because I surely should have been. I really should have been. Well, this man and I were not able to patch up our relationship, and we ended up divorcing. I'm sorry, but I get dry when I talk. So I moved into an apartment with this girlfriend, and she and I began to run around. And we would run every weekend. You know, we would go downtown to the bars and party and really have a good time. And this is when I started to have blackouts. Now, I was a daily drinker, but only getting really drunk on the weekends. And we would go down there and drink, and I'd drive home, and I don't remember getting home. This one night, I had no idea how we got from downtown way out in the East End. And I thought, man, this is weird. I am not telling anybody. Because I'd never heard anybody talk about blackouts. I didn't know what it was. But I sure wasn't going to tell anybody what was going on. Continued to drink. Now, I got to tell y'all how many times I've been married right now. Because if I don't, I see people down there and they're like counting, you know, trying to keep track. And so I need to tell you now, I've been married 4 times, and I know that at least 3 of them are the direct result of my alcoholism. So I hadn't been dating anybody for a couple of years, and I needed a date for a company function. I had finally gotten into a good job. I got into the insurance industry, and I ended up staying in the insurance industry until I died. I never dreamed that that was going to be my career, but I loved it. And so a friend of my mother's fixed me up with this young man. He came from the same area of town that I came from. He came from a nice family. He had a college education. He had a car. He had a good job. He had all the criteria. And he just swept me off my feet, and so we got married. We got married. You know, I didn't just date people. I married them. You know, I can laugh about that today, but when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was filled with a lot of shame about that. You know, what a failure I was. But anyway, we got married, and I continued to drink, but I had a problem because he wasn't an alcoholic, and he didn't drink like I did. And he would say these really, really stupid things to me like, "Laurel, why can't you just have two drinks, you know, and then stop? You know, do you really need to drink tonight?" You know, and all that kind of crazy stuff. And he was really bugging me. And I could not drink the way that I wanted to because of him. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the questions was, "Did you ever hide your alcohol?" I said, "No." But here's what I would do at night. He'd be in there watching TV, and I'd be preparing supper. We had long supper preparation. And I'd be in there making my vodka martinis and, you know, putting it behind the coffee pot and, you know, drinking some more, adding a little bit more to it. And if he came in, "Oh, it's still just the same first drink." Now, if that's not hiding my alcohol, I don't know what it is. That's hiding it. So we've been married about a year and a half and had moved up to Cincinnati with his job, and I was miserable. And I decided I needed to divorce him, and he was crimping my style. So we got a divorce. He was a really nice man, and I have since made amends to him, and I'm so glad that I did, because I hurt him a lot. My alcoholism destroyed that marriage. And was on vacation down in Florida, and I met this man who is from New Jersey, and he drank like I did. And I thought, that's the ticket, that's the answer. You know, just get one that drinks like I do, and everything will be fine. And so we started this romance, you know, from New Jersey to Ohio, and we knew each other about 3 months, and we got married. And I was drunk when I married him, and we drank daily, got up in the morning, and he fixed mimosas and Bloody Marys and all these fancy things I'd never had before, and oh, it was great. And then we were packed up my car with all my belongings, and we headed down the road. And I tell y'all, I got to tell you about how I drank in Cincinnati before I tell you what happened to Tom and I when we left there. When I was living in Cincinnati and doing all this drinking, I would come back to Louisville a lot because I was homesick. And when I'd leave on Friday afternoons, I'd fill up this tumbler this big with ice and just pour the vodka in on top. And I'd head down I-71 going 85 miles an hour at least. And I had this big fat cat. I was telling her before the meeting that I had this cat. This cat was neurotic by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd take her and I'd hang her around my shoulders. Now, I had this big bomb of a car, and she and I would take off going down the road, you know, and this cat around my neck. You know, but for the grace of God, you know, I could have killed a busload of people, you know. It could have been me as well as it was somebody else. So anyway, Tom and I, we start down to Florida. We're going to move down there for the good life. And I've got this cat around my shoulder, and we have our drinks, and we got the car all piled up with stuff, and we're heading down the road, and I had this tiny 3-second bit of sanity, and I looked over at him, and I thought, "Oh my God, what have I done? You know, I have married this man, and I don't even know him." So we went to Florida, and I'd been taught, you know, "You've made your bed, now you lie in it." You know, that was one of those old adages from the South. And I thought that that's what I had to do, and I had to drink daily to live. And I remember my first conscious drink that I took in the morning. Now, these other drinks had been, I don't know, I had some kind of deal of where you couldn't have this before 10, and then after 10 you could have that, and from 10 to 6 you could have something else, and then after that it was, you know, Katie bar the door, you could have anything you wanted. Well, this particular morning, I got up and I was so miserable, and I poured some gin in a tumbler, and I went and took a bath, and I thought, well, Laurel, this is it. It was like, cheers. You know, you're on the road, to death. You know, I knew that there was something wrong with my drinking. I never saw people drink like me. I knew that there was something really, really wrong with it. So I continued to drink, fly back to Louisville. I spent more time in airports and flying back home than I did with this man. And I'd get drunk. Every time I got on a plane, I got drunk. You know, I'd be in airports. Airports are real slippery places for me. You know, it's real dangerous. Men would buy me drinks, and I'd drink, and I'd get off the plane drunk. And, you know, my mother said I looked like the wrath of God. I'd be skinny, and I'd get off the plane, and I'd be staggering around, you know. And my parents were so good to me. And this man and I, it was just volatile. He abused me physically, mentally, and emotionally. And one night he had a gun and he was chasing me around this little town in Florida that we were living in. And I thought, I've got to leave. I know I'm going to die. This guy's going to kill me. So I packed all my cat and my stuff and drove up to Tampa, and we took a plane back, and I left him. And my stepfather helped me get my things out of Florida. So here I am, 29 years old, almost 29 years old, living back home with my mom and dad. All my furniture's in storage. I don't have a job, I don't have anything, and I'm drinking around the clock. I drank alcohol in anything that I could drink it in. Iced tea, milk, pineapple juice, you know, anything. I would go out and buy myself like a bottle of champagne. Now, this is how sick I was. I'd buy a bottle of champagne, and I would drink it riding around in my car. I don't know what I was celebrating. You know, I was so sick. And my parents were trying to do the best they could. They knew I was really in trouble, but they didn't know what to do. And this one particular night, I had been out drinking with some friends of mine that I had worked with back in Louisville, and I could not take my car because it was a bomb, you know, and I had to look good. If I looked good on the outside, you wouldn't know if I was dying on the inside. And I went out drinking with her, and on the way home, I'm going down I-64, and I lost control of the car, and it's through this area where there's cliffs along this tunnel that you go through, and this truck was beside me, and I lost control of the car, and I just rammed into the guardrail and started back over in the direction of the cliffs. For some reason, I was able to stop the car. I had totaled the whole side of their car, and that's the grace of God. I mean, I should be dead over and over and over again. No, it's a miracle that I'm able to stand up here today. Well, I thought that I called my parents. I got a ride to this convenience store and thought I had called my parents to come and pick me up, but about a year ago, I was talking to my mother about it, and she said, "We didn't come pick you up. Your second husband came and picked you up, and I didn't remember that. I was in a blackout. When I got home, my mother was so angry with me. Now, I had never been abused. I mean, I had my bottom paddled when I was a child, or my legs switched, or whatever I needed, but she started hitting me. And she just couldn't quit. She just started hitting me. And I felt, you know, I thought, I deserved this. My stepfather, you know, finally got her off, and she was crying and crying. And the next morning when I got up, I was sore. I wasn't really hurt anywhere. But when I looked at myself in the mirror, God, I hated myself. Who had I become? I certainly wasn't the person that they had raised. You know, who had I become? What had alcohol done to me? And that Christmas, I went down to Nashville to spend some time with my family. And being the good alcoholic that I am, I was griping and moaning about this man I was getting a divorce from and his drinking. And she said, "You need to go to Al-Anon. It would probably really help you." And the reason that she knew about that is her husband, whom I admired greatly, he was an alcoholic, and he had gotten sober. And he'd gotten sober by going to AA. And she said, "You need to go to Al-Anon." And this little voice in the back of my head said, "You don't need Al-Anon. You need Alcoholics Anonymous." And she gave me some literature, and I read it, and it was still like a couple of months before I finally made it to my first AA meeting. I had gotten a part-time job for an attorney, and my routine was get up in the morning and try to get something down me. I mean, I was really to the point where I was having a lot of gastric trouble, sore throat all the time. The tips of my fingers had little blisters on them from the nerve endings being so raw. And I'd get up, and whether it was NyQuil or alcohol, whatever I could get to stay down me that day, and I would go into work, try to work for a couple of hours, go out at lunch, and I would buy a pint of liquor, and I would drink it and go back to the office. And I remember this one day, this attorney said to me, "Have you been drinking?" And I said, "No, but I wish I was." I mean, lying, filled with anger and rage. And this one day, I went out doing my same routine on this cold winter day in January, got my half pint, and I drank it, and I stopped by a phone booth, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wanted them to come out to that phone booth and rescue me right that minute. And they said, "Can we have your number and have someone call you back?" And I said, no. Hung up the phone, and I went back to the office, and I told them, I said, "I'm so sorry, but I have got to leave. I'm really sick. I have got to do something." And they knew I was really sick, and they let me go. And I went to a meeting that night with a friend of mine who had a friend who was an alcoholism counselor, and I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on January the 25th, 1982. And it was a Schnitzelberg meeting, and it was a lot of men in there and a lot of smoke, and it was loud. Oh, my ears hurt. But there was something I wanted. I mean, I liked it. They were laughing and, you know, seemed to be happy, and I had no alternative. Now, I had gotten a job somehow or another with an insurance company that I was going to be starting in about 10 days, and I knew I couldn't continue to drink the way that I did, and I had to get my act together. So the next day, I went up to the Token Club in Louisville, and there were some women up there who just like took me under their wings and began to nurture me back to health. Oh, God, how I love those women. You know, I didn't know anything about detoxing. And they started, you know, having me put orange juice and honey together and drinking that, and they would feed me and they would talk to me. And I remember one of the first things that one of those ladies said to me, she said, "Do you believe in God?" And I thought, what an absurd question. Well, I said, "Sure I do." And she says, "Good, it'll make it easier for you." I still didn't have a clue. They gave me a big book, and I hung up there just constantly for the next 10 days, trying to stay sober. And little by little, I did begin to get some sobriety. And I can't say that that first meeting that I went to that I stopped drinking, because I didn't. There were many nights that I'd go home after an AA meeting and I'd stop by the liquor store and get a split of champagne and drink that and go home. But I kept going back. And I need to talk about the things that I did in recovery that time. Because my sobriety date is September the 6th, 1988. And I need to talk about those 5 years and then the year and a half that I drank, because it's important to know the mistakes that I made. You know, they talk about the steps of the program, and I read those things, and I thought, well, yeah, I can do that. And the first one where, you know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable, I thought, yeah, my life is unmanageable, and right now I'm pretty powerless over alcohol. But I had this reservation that lurked in the back of my mind that someday I would be able to drink like other people. You know, I saw you all laughing and smiling and having a good time. I thought, surely these people can't be having that good of a time and they're, you know, not drinking. How could they do that? I couldn't believe it. So anyway, then the second step, I didn't like that one because it said I was insane, and I didn't want to be insane, so I just disregarded that step completely. And then when it came to step three, I did not read the chapter We Agnostics in Alcoholics Anonymous. Why did I need to read that? I believed in God. That didn't apply to me. It was for you all. And so when I turned my life and will over to the care of God of my understanding, I just said, okay, here I am. You know, just me and Him. Okay, this is it. Step four, I did it in my head, and I did my fifth step with an alcoholism counselor, and I only told her what I wanted her to hear. I did not tell her the whole truth. Six and seven, I didn't even know what those meant. Step eight and nine, yes, I made a mental list, and I made amends to those people who were very, very close to me in my life that I needed to make amends to. That was it. And further, I failed to enlarge my spiritual life. But I still managed to stay sober. I had met my husband, Jerry, about this time, and oh God, I love these new girls that I sponsor, you know. And he had been sober for a couple of years. I met him through the program, and I was really, really fortunate because I fell in with some winners like Ro and Sheila. I was so lucky. And I met him, and you know, I fell in love with him. Absolutely fell in love with him, and I guess he did me, and 6 months later we got married. And I know that there were people in AA that were laying wagers that it would never last, you know, and we're still married today because of this program. Everything I have today I owe to this program. Well, he had been married before, and he had two children. One of them was 13, and the other was 16, and he had custody of both these kids, and they were very sick kids from the disease of alcoholism. I was 29 years old. I had never had any children. I didn't have a clue. I was so naive. And we struggled. We really struggled. And Ro and Sheila were so great for us. They helped us, you know, work through so many problems that we had during this period of time, but we kept trying. You know, we kept going to meetings and we kept trying, and things began to get better. His son chose to move out and move in with his mother, and subsequently started on his road to getting here. And then his daughter, I mean, we just tried to blend this family, and it was really tough. But I was doing well with my job. I had been promoted and promoted and promoted. I had gotten my first new car. We were beginning to get our bills paid off. We were taking trips like going to Hawaii on vacation, and I had been promoted to vice president of an insurance company. I was like dumbfounded. I couldn't believe it. Now, during this period of time, I had gotten a resentment against a couple of people in AA because they didn't invite me to participate in an event that they had going on in their lives, and I was really, really hurt. So I decided to change meetings and go to the ones where they weren't. You know, that sounded good, except that I was not going to the meetings that were important to me. So then they started to dwindle off. You know, you always hear these people who relapse say that the first thing that they did is they stopped going to meetings. You know, for about 2 years, we did not go to meetings regularly at all. You know, sometimes we'd go to a conference, you know, but that was it. And, you know, we were doing pretty well. And we were on a business trip coming back from Florida, and we were on an airplane. Oh, God, these airplanes. And here comes the stewardess with that cart down the middle of the aisle, and she said, "Would you all care for a cocktail?" And I said, "Yes, I believe I will." Now, all the knowledge that I had gained, the self-knowledge, that didn't keep me sober. Did I think to ask God to help me? No. I think I'd been setting myself up for that drink for years before that. Been setting myself up. And he also ordered a drink. He drank his and he was done. I wanted another one then. And I began to connive and plot and think, how was I going to get that next drink? And I thought, now I can control this thing. It's just those men I was married to. My life was a mess. You know, everything's fine now. I can control it. We were going down the escalator at the airport, and I'm thinking, my mind's going like this. How am I going to get that next drink? How am I going to do this thing and work? Well, that set off a year and a half of the most horrible hell in my life. It was awful. All of the things that I had learned in AA were there. They were still there. You know, it says AA screws up your drinking. It does. You can never, never drink again like you used to. I was filled with just guilt and shame and remorse. My husband would look at me with disgust. I mean, he was not having a problem with his alcohol. He would look at me with disgust. Everything that our marriage had been based on, you know, the program, that's where we met, that's all we knew. He'd never seen me drunk. It was down the tubes. I tried to go back to some AA meetings. I called Sheila and Ro. And I remember one night, I was telling somebody about it this weekend. I was in the shower trying to get ready to come to the meeting, and I was so drunk. I kept falling down in the shower. And it finally got to the meeting, and I had to hold on to the sides of the chair just to sit there. I was so drunk, I almost fell out of the chair. They just kept on loving me. They never judged me. I would go shopping up at Kroger's, and my routine was to go through this liquor store where they had a drive-in window. They'd hand me out a half pint, and I would drink it with the insane idea that I was going to get sober by the time I got done grocery shopping. You know, I'd drink that half pint before I went in Kroger, and I'd be just flying through. I never liked to grocery shop. And then I'd come, leave there, and I'd think, well, I better get another half pint just in case I need another one. So I'd go back and get another half pint, and I'd come home, staggering in, groceries falling everywhere, and my husband would look at me and he'd say, I have never known anyone who can go to the grocery store and come home drunk. I can laugh about it now, but it was horrible then. Well, I had been on this big binge over Labor Day weekend and had gone down to Nashville. That was always my going home place, go to Nashville. And I'd come back and I thought I'd get my act cleaned up and go to work on Tuesday. Well, Tuesday morning came and I couldn't go to work. I could not stop drinking. Went up to the liquor store and I got a half pint at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I called in sick. 10 o'clock, I was back up there getting another half pint. And I was laying on the couch and I thought, you know, God, I'm at the gates of hell. Now I know I'm going to die. I am either going to kill myself or I'm going to drink myself to death. And I'd been praying every night, please, God, just don't let me wake up. Let me just not wake up tomorrow. And God's grace allowed me to call this woman who is a psychiatrist and a friend of mine, and I told her, I said, I can't stop drinking. I've got to get a bed somewhere. And I told her I wanted to go in Our Lady of Peace because I knew the guy who was the personnel director there. I mean, that's a stupid reason to want to go to an institution to get dried out, but that was my reason, and it doesn't matter what it is, but God, I'm so grateful. Whew, I called Jerry. Well, let me tell you this. My mother came in over there to see me. I'd called her and told her I was going to go in the hospital, I'd passed out, and I was laying there on the couch, and I kind of opened my eyes and looked up, and there she stood, and she was looking at me, and she had tears in her eyes. You know, I'm her only child, and she loved me better than life itself. And she said, honey, if there's anything I can do, just let me know. And she left. Called Jerry. He came home and got me. We got to Our Lady of Peace. I was so sick on the way there, I thought I was going to throw up before we got there. And, you know, my tolerance level in the beginning, I could drink like a man. You know, it was part of what I loved about myself. I could drink any guy under the table. But by then, it didn't matter how much I had. I was drunk, no matter how much. And I was belligerent and hateful when we got there. And wanted them to process me right away. And they finally got me up to my room. And they took all my stuff away from me. You know, my scissors, my nail clippers, my hairspray, perfume, you know, anything I had with me, they took it away from me, and they made me strip so that they could check my body for bruises and stuff. Boy, I learned some humility. I learned some real humility, this little girl who, thought I was so good. And it's the best lesson I ever learned in my life. I was only going to stay in there 3 days, and this psychiatrist came in and talked to me, and he said, you are one of the most angry people I have ever met in my life. And I'm like, me? Angry? You know? Yeah, I'd pour that alcohol in on top of that anger, and I'd be in a full-blown rage, but I thought I could control it. I was so sick, but I was willing to go to any lengths to get sober. I knew that AA had the answer. That was the only thing that had ever worked for me. I'd been to psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, counselors, ministers, you name it. I'd been there trying to get the answer. And the only time I had ever felt any peace at all was when I was in AA. So I started on this 30 days. Oh, I got to tell you this, the funniest thing. I had a roommate, and at this point, there was about 40 people in the treatment facility there at Our Lady of Peace. Now they're lucky if they have 14. That kind of goes like that. And there were 14 women there, and this roommate of mine called all the other women into my room to smell me. I mean, I reeked of alcohol. It just was out of every pore of my body. So I'm standing there crying and at that window looking out over that hill, and I said, oh God, please just help me. Just help me. I'll do anything if you'll help me. So I had a willingness to go to any lengths that I never had had before. And those were the best 30 days that I've ever spent in my life. You know, I was real fortunate that, you know, the men were separated from the women because I couldn't have gotten honest in a room full of men. And I had a counselor who was tough. And she confronted me on a lot of things that I didn't want to deal with, like possibly my addiction to men and relationships. The fact that I didn't have any women friends to speak of. I had maybe one or two, and I really needed women friends. And I said, I'll do anything. If y'all want me to go jump off the Kennedy Bridge, I'll do it. So when I got out of there, I got a sponsor almost right away, and I let Ro recommend somebody to me. And I kept looking at her thinking, now, is she the right one, you know? Because I wanted her to be perfect, and I was so afraid that if I went up to her and asked her to be my sponsor, she'd say no. She didn't say no. I got into a step study group, and I really, really worked the steps. I knew I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was totally unmanageable, and the longer that I stay sober, you know, at that point I thought, well, I can manage some things. I knew I couldn't manage people, places, and things, but I thought I could manage myself. I realize now how powerless I am. I don't have any power. That's the root of all my problem. I don't have any power. And I knew I was insane by this point and that God could restore me to sanity, and I began to believe that. Now, I wanted this spiritual part of this program more than anything in the world because that's what had eluded me the first time. And I kept searching to try to find it. And when I did my third step the first time with this group of women, we got down on our knees together, and we said it, and we were holding hands, and I thought, oh my God, this is really it. I'm making a commitment. These people are my witnesses. They're hearing everything I'm saying. My fourth step was 42 pages long of resentments and fear in relationships. When I did my fifth step, I did not do it with a counselor or somebody I'd never see again. I knew I needed someone that I was going to see at the meetings on a regular basis who could look me in the eye and know everything about me. And I was afraid. I was afraid she was going to stop loving me after I told her every dirty, rotten thing I'd ever done in my life, and she didn't. And I cried when I got done with that fifth step. And she said, do you see that that's not really you? Do you see that that's what the alcohol has done to you? And it was so perfectly clear. Six and seven, I don't think I even worked them this time, that first time, because I was just so relieved to get that fifth step done. I did make a list of people I needed to make amends to and began making amends. Now, this time in sobriety, I've worked the steps more than one time. I probably worked them at least once a year thoroughly all the way through, because I love them. Whenever I get into some pain or some trouble, I work those steps. You know, I believe in them. And, you know, I feel like, too, that if you work the steps ahead of time, that when the pain and trouble comes, it's not going to be so bad. And the most spiritual steps that I have found for me are steps six and seven. In one of my step study groups, I was going through it again, and I had to really look at that step because I had not done anything with it. And I thought, yeah, I'm ready to work this step. But then I started getting afraid, and I thought, why am I so afraid? Why don't I want to work these steps? And it's because I was afraid that I would have to change. I was really committing to being willing to change. And I was scared of that because some of my character defects had served me very well in the past, and I didn't want to give them up. And I was taking this step with my sponsor, and she told me, look, God's not going to take anything away from you until he knows you're ready. He didn't carry you this far to just drop you. He'll fill you up with something else as he takes those character defects away. And oh God, it was just wonderful to hear that. I went way back in my past to make amends, and I'm talking about two-bit penny ante amends, like stealing from the corner drugstore. I sent, you know, the money anonymously with a letter. I sent it to a convenience store where I had stolen beer, you know, sent the money back. Those little things were haunting me. Yeah, I had done all of, you know, step 8 and 9. Those little things were really haunting me, and it was a relief to get rid of them. In this first year of sobriety, it was really hard for me. I struggled a lot. I had major panic and anxiety attacks, which I would have in the past drank to try to get rid of them. I was searching for this God that I just couldn't seem to grasp a hold of. I was doing everything you all told me to do, get down on my knees and pray, but I just didn't feel any personal contact. Somebody told me, Laura, you know, you don't have to feel spiritual to be spiritual. I thought, well, what a novel idea. I thought that if I was spiritual, I was constantly going to be up in the clouds, you know. They said, no, you don't have to be like that. And at the end of this year and a half of being in this step study group, I was crying and moaning about not having had a psychic change and not having had a spiritual awakening. And one of the women in the step study group looked at me and she said, you are no more the same person that you were a year and a half ago than anything. I said, I'm not. No, I needed to hear that. I needed to hear that I had changed. So God and I started out on this journey together, and man, has it been interesting. I love sobriety. I wouldn't go back for anything in the world. I've had wonderful things happen to me in sobriety. My husband and I have got to take a lot of good trips together. My stepdaughter asked me to be her matron of honor when she got married. Oh man, that's priceless. I couldn't have done that if I was drinking. She wouldn't have wanted me even at the wedding, much less her matron of honor. I had a good job. That company kept me there. The president of the company came up to see me when I was in treatment, and he still wanted me there. And I worked there for about 2 more years, and then I retired. What? How fortunate. I mean, I really got lucky enough to be able to retire. And it's nothing that I did. All of this is from God. Every bit of it is a gift. You know, I don't own you people. I don't own the people in my life. They're just a gift on loan to me from God. Anything that I have on is just a gift that I'm getting to use while I'm down here. That's all it is. So I retired and wanted to spend some time with my mother. I just had this real burning desire, this real need to do that. Her health was not the greatest in the world at that time, and I wanted to spend some time with her. And after I had been off from work for a couple of years, by this point I guess I was maybe about 4.5, 5 years sober, a series of events began to occur in sobriety that were not pleasant and were not happy. And I want to talk about them because there's a message to be said in this. You know, a lot of times we hear speakers get up here and they say everything is just perfect in sobriety, it's just rosy. Well, it isn't for me. Life continues to happen. And I need to know that other people have walked through pain in sobriety and have come out on the other side with their faith increased, that they made it. I had 2 miscarriages, like about a year apart. And my husband and I had wanted to have a child very, very much. And it was just not meant to be. And for a while, I was angry about that. I just hated God. You know, why do you hate me so bad that you don't even want me to be recreated? And I'd pray an angry prayer, and God would just relieve that pain from me. It was amazing. Then my dad died, my real father, and he and I had reestablished a relationship. And, you know, I liked him. He had quit drinking. And he died very, very suddenly. Then shortly after that, we found out that my husband's brother in California had cancer. And we went out there, and it was like he was waiting for us. And we got out there, and he passed away while we were there. And I had something to offer that family, his wife and his daughter. I had something to offer them because I could sit there and tell them, yes, I believe that there's a power greater than myself that can help us get through any of this. Then my aunt had to be put in a hospital because, in a nursing home after she was in the hospital because she had Alzheimer's. What a sad disease, you know, to watch somebody deteriorate before your very eyes. And I was made her legal guardian because she was, you know, unable to do it. And my stepfather, he couldn't do it because he's 80-something years old himself at that time. And then my mother got real sick. She had been sick, but she had a chronic lung disease, and it had progressed. And for a year and a half, my life revolved around my aunt and especially my mother. You know, my mother died in May a year ago. And the time that I talked where they taped me, Milton and them listened to the tape. And when they asked me to speak up here, and I thought, I'm not that same person. You know, that was only 3 months after she had died, and I was in some kind of state of shock, and I was standing up there, and I thought I was fine. Well, I wasn't fine. You know, 3 months later, I went into a terrible major depression in sobriety. But the gifts that this program gave me was the ability to be there for my mother, to do things for her that she had done for me when I was a child. You know, to hold her and to love her and to say to her when she was dying, Mommy, you know, I'll be there in just a brief flicker of an instant. I'll be there with you. Now, if I were drinking, I couldn't have done that. And I'm so grateful for this program. I am truly, it has given me my life. And it has helped me serve the lives of others. And that's all I want to do. That's all I want to do today. You know, and I miss her more than anything in the world, and I probably always will. But you all have given me the grace to accept the pain and just keep going. Now, could I have done this? You know, any other time, any other way, no, I would have used alcohol to kill that pain. And I thought sometimes that I wasn't going to make it. This last year, I thought I'm not going to make it. My sponsor was there for me, the people I sponsor, my friends, and I didn't drink. That's the message. You can have pain and you don't have to drink. Well, last year has been interesting for me, to say the least. I've done another four-step, fifth step. I work with a lot of people, and they have helped me so much to stay sober. I love to sponsor women. It's just the best. And, you know, they were there for me. And, you know, I gave them hope that, yes, you can go through these things and you don't have to drink. And I have been trying to get my life kind of back in order. My aunt died the month before my mother did. My aunt died in April, and then mother died in May. And for the last year, I have just been sort of like letting my feelings heal. I've never had time to heal in the last 2 years from one thing that happened after another. And I've been trying to be real gentle on myself. Not get into that caregiving mode again where I'm taking care of everybody and not taking care of me. And I've started going back to school. I'm thinking about working on another undergraduate degree. And this time it's in art. I had thought maybe I wanted to do expressive art therapy, but I've gotten so that just loving the art. I just want to do that. It's an expression of me inside. I go to lots of meetings. My home group is the St. Matthew's Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I do have a sponsor, and I do sponsor people. And I'm in that big book, in the 12 and 12, and I'm reading those. And I have a little grandbaby. And he is the cutest, most precious thing that ever walked this earth. And he, you know what? He just loves me. He sits on my lap and he pats my face and he says, Mimi, I love you. And my heart just melts. You know, so there are lots of blessings that are still in my life. I have the most wonderful relationship with my husband. I adore him. And I think he really loves me too. And that is so nice. And Al-Anon, I can't say enough good things about them. He ended up getting back in the Al-Anon program, and honestly, that's where he belonged because he never had any trouble with drinking. And he works a mean Al-Anon program. He is really good. And it's helped us a lot. You know, our lives are going in the same direction together, and we're committed to one another and to the relationship. And one of the neatest things that has happened in the last 6 months is this boy of his that I was telling you about. He's almost 30 years old now. He'd been drinking and drugging for 15 years. And he finally ended up in a real penitentiary out in California. He started writing me, writing his dad, and he's found God out there. Oh, God, that is so neat. Those letters are just so full of the Spirit. It's beautiful. And you know, it's a little scary because he might change tomorrow, but I don't have to worry about that. This is one day at a time. I truly understand that now, one day at a time. And right now, he's in God's care. And he's right where he's supposed to be. I've run over a little bit, but I thank you all for listening to me. And you know, if there's any message for anybody, it's just keep coming back. Read the big book, get a sponsor, work the steps, and go to meetings. Thank you all for letting me treat my disease.